This is the Flannery Podcast, episode 20. Impeached forever. Is Trump bleeding out? That's our issue for today. Stay tuned. Our issue today is impeached forever. Is Trump bleeding out? And I'm thinking that the impeachment was more important than the general public considered. Let's consider the fact that we're living in the political theater of the absurd, directed by and starring Donald Trump. The crimes Trump committed to become our chief executive and the obstruction of any investigation of his crimes since he stole the office haunt his efforts to continue in office this presidential election year. It was all out there in the open for any one of us to see. In my opinion, Trump was mortally wounded politically in the impeachment proceedings, and we can see it in his desperate efforts since to scrub clean this indelible mark on his defective character, to erase every morsel of evidence from any whistleblower or conspirator or documents, tax records he's kept over the years that could reveal what we all know or believe to be true. Wounded in the impeachment were Trump's two pliable senators who saw no evil, heard no evil, who stood by their man, who knows why, out of fear and the hope he'd help them stay in the big show in the Senate. Republican Senator Susan Collins stood by Trump, said he was innocent, acquitted him. And then she said afterwards, what did she think was the effect on Mr. Trump? And she said Trump learned a lesson from the impeachment proceedings. Not true, of course. We all know that. She had to know that when she said it. Ridiculous, you might say. Collins lamely tried to convince the Maine voters she'd done the right thing, voting Trump's acquittal, standing by her man, the orange menace in the West Wing. So, what do the voters think? In this last week, Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon, seeking to give Collins the heave-ho in this election year to replace her, is pulling ahead of Susan. And she's now 46-42. A close vote could change, but still, those are encouraging polling returns. We can hope that Sarah goes all the way, and she won't be the only senator who's going to be under siege because of how they handled the impeachment. As for what Trump learned, he displaced those who testified of his crimes in the Ukraine. He doubled down on vengeance against those who blew the whistle on him. He's working hard, even to this day, even this past weekend, to buy the silence of those who can tell the truth. You know, Flynn and that crazy guy Stone. I firmly believe that Clinton's impeachment proceedings, yes, Clinton, while it didn't result in a conviction, cast a long, dark shadow over Al Gore's chances to succeed Clinton in the Oval Office. Clinton's impeachment was, in my opinion, Gore's truly inconvenient truth. Now, some experienced political hands discredit the Clinton impeachment of having any effect. But consider the fact that Gore took it seriously. He knew it mattered. He tried to discount the Clinton effect by keeping his distance from Wild Bill in the campaign. But it wasn't effective. Nothing could have been effective, probably. And there was also too much corruption in that election from the Bush side, especially in Florida, brought the whole thing to a halt when the Supreme Court interfered to declare Bush the winner. Talk about voter suppression. But that is voter suppression. After all, the Republicans' favorite tactic to win any election. And it gets worse year by year because, year by year, they're losing the support of the voters. And this may be the lowest year that they can garner votes from anybody to get elected. And we're talking about both houses of Congress and the President of the United States. The Supreme Court, back there in Bush against Gore, risked his brand to write an opinion in one case that couldn't be cited in any other case. That's what the decision said. It mattered that Clinton wasn't running again to Clinton, but it was too bad for Gore. The end of a worthy dream, the saddest words of song or pen, what could have been. In Trump's case, after his impeachment, he suffers that stain. It's obvious to anyone. It's reported by those close to him. He can't shake it. He can't remove it. He's running again in the same year that he was tried by the Senate, so to speak, in a show trial without a single witness appearing and with the corrupt, biased leadership of Moscow Mitch. Trump is now, in my opinion, bleeding out, metaphorically, like a bad crime scene in one of those untouchable movies, an open, visceral wound that he can't heal and can't find an emergency room to fix him up, but he's trying. Absurd. I talked about the theater of the absurd. Absurd, the dictionary says, is out of harmony with reason or propriety, incongruous, unreasonable, illogical. Those are some of the descriptions that come to mind when we think of Trump. In the theater of the absurd, according to Ionesco, absurd means cut off from religious, metaphysical, and transcendental roots where man is lost and his actions become senseless, absurd, useless. Well, Trump is a chaos machine, tearing down what are at the root of our American identity, equality, legality. From his walk down that escalator, gold as a backdrop, a paid crowd to cheer, Trump announced his candidacy with a campaign that from the start set out to devalue our ideals and to smudge and destroy the purity and purpose of America. Sartre argued that existence comes before essence. You are what you do. By that standard, Trump is more like a mafiosa than a president, a petty dictator rather than a representative of the people, a person out for himself rather than a servant of the people. Whether a mob boss or a Putin puppet, Trump has isolated the nation, compromised our standing among democratic nations, made the world unsafe, embraced racism, ignored science, ignored the Constitution and the law, and issued fiats that harm the nation and its people. I was always of the view that impeachment, whether Trump was convicted or not, would determine his reelection. We'll find out, obviously. Judging by his recent conduct, I think he believes it matters as well. That it hurts and still hurts, and just maybe he's concerned about being prosecuted if he loses this election, we can only hope, and having to wear an orange jumpsuit in a Bureau of Prisons guest house. Trump's advisors don't encourage him to be a better leader. They just have a different view of what he can get away with. And right now, it's less, not more, and it's about time that he should be called out on multiple fronts as he's dropping like a stone in the polls, even as he's commuting the sentence of stone. There are at least two big issues that have brought him down. First, his obstruction of justice in various ways to smudge that stain of impeachment to make him look just a little bit better, enough to be reelected for his pride, and so he may get reelected. A look at the court for this question. More on that shortly. Second, his promotion of the virus, pushing people to work, pushing children to school, knowing infections and death will surely continue to climb and follow, but not caring to do otherwise, not caring to limit the risk. Nor does his education secretary, Betsy Cruella DeVos. The facts, the number of infections and the deaths put the lie to his oleaginous declarations that he cares, when plainly he doesn't care at all. The longer he does this, the more likely the truth will sink in, even for his true believers, his ditto heads, those people who will follow him anywhere. More on this as well. One nagging question about Trump's supporters has to be, what are they thinking? Are they thinking at all to support him before, now, or ever? I've talked about this in earlier podcasts, but I have a couple of additional thoughts about the construct by which these people can exist. There are a couple of explanations you might want to consider. First, there is the consensus trance, coined by psychologist Charles Tart, as a state of consciousness produced by ideologically blunting of our intellect through intensive manipulation, brainwashing, forcing one to accept a false conception of reality. You could also call this groupthink. It's in their terms, a consensus reality orientation. Now, there may be a duel about which side has been brainwashed, and that's where facts, logics, and science becomes the tiebreaker. It comes in to serve to inform us as to who is right. Think about Ibsen, the great playwright, his play, Enemy of the People, when the protagonist doctor warns the community about unsafe water sources, expecting to be the hero by disclosing this for finding it. But he's treated instead as the enemy. because the water springs are an anticipated big deal for the town's economic prosperity. So he is shunned, he is banished, he is humiliated. The consensus translates into a resistance to what may be true by punishing, scolding, or merely shushing. Those in the trance are not good with things that disturb their routine or expectations. Trump doesn't seem to be a very patient or flexible man, does he? Second, there's another study. The Dunning-Kruger effect is another kind of study, and it may best have been foreshadowed a long time ago by Charles Darwin, who wrote, "Ignorance more frequently begets confidence than does knowledge." Now, what psychologists David Dunning and Justin Kruger did was look for those who scored in the lowest percentiles on tests of grammar, humor, and logic, and found they tended to overestimate dramatically how well they performed. Now, low performers are unable to recognize, sorry to say, the skill and competence levels of other people, which is part of the reason why they consistently view themselves as better, more capable, and more knowledgeable than others. Well, I have a confession to make. In college, when talking for my amusement, and I was always studying words, I occasionally made up a word that didn't exist, and I used it in a conversation. Say, Jim refluxuated the nether spout, and it works fine now. And the reaction? No one asked what the terms meant, the ones I made up. They somehow or other assumed they were correct, and they couldn't possibly have understood them, so I thought. But it turns out that Dunning and Kruger found out that 90% of the respondents claimed they had at least some knowledge of completely made-up terms they were asked about by Dunning and Kruger. Maybe I should have become a psychologist. I could have had that study. They had a much larger sample size, however, than my ad hoc college experiment, which was arbitrary and rare. But their stunts were more precise, and they reached that finding. So those are two categories. But what do we do about another category, those people who are creating this consensus, taking advantage of the Dunning-Kruger effect, say Fox or Trump or any of his cronies? Well, they know what they're doing. They know what's true, and they're doing something they know is false, and they're hurting people, compromising rights and liberties, and in the case of the virus, even causing them to become ill, and some, many, to die. So these people are nothing more than crooks, and they're taking advantage of others who may suffer from these things that we've mentioned, but they know what they're doing. They're taking advantage of them. Well, let's get down to cases on Trump. Stay tuned.
And we are living in the golden age of lies. Now's the time to be a liar, and Donald Trump is liar in chief.
Let's consider the stain on Trump's black soul. When Trump first took office, in the shadow of his inauguration, I thought there were several paths, as I believed his arc was toward monarchy. And we had to gird for battle to deflect that course. I thought there were several ways to do this. First, I thought Congress had the power of the purse. Censure, hearings, subpoena, and impeachment. Second, the courts could consider causes of action challenging Trump's corrupt misconduct, either by individuals or the Congress or different agencies, all sorts of interest groups. Third, there was the power of protest by the people to affect the Congress and perhaps the courts. The last prong, protest, well, that was almost immediately invoked by the Women's March on Washington that I attended the day after Trump's inauguration. And since, we've had a strong public voice, and especially since the gruesome death of George Floyd, that has promoted across the nation people mad that we have systemic racism, that people are dying unnecessarily, and because probably what they've learned about the police being indiscriminate and how they would abuse others, maybe not as severely as persons of color, but this is a problem nationwide. Now, Congress has always been slow on its attack, but the House Dems did proud to impeach and hold hearings, and we've uncovered several heroes, including Congressman Schiff. The courts have not been as consistently strong as I hoped, not with Moscow Mitch packing the courts as much as he has with Federalist nominees. But the Supreme Court has finished up this term with several decisions that seemingly seek to preserve the court's bipartisan authority and check the excesses of Trump. In recent days, the Supreme Court has extended, for example, protections against discrimination under the Civil Rights Act because a person is gay or transgender. The Supreme Court found an undue burden under Louisiana law to mandate restrictive conditions on available facilities for a woman to have an abortion. The Supreme Court protected Dreamers, the children of unlawful immigrants, against Trump's effort to dismantle the program. And they saved 650,000 persons that might have to be removed from our country. Persons otherwise without a country, other than the one the parents chose that they had nothing to do with. For now, they may remain. Finally, the most watched decision of the Supreme Court this term was the decision on the president's taxes. Everybody wants to see them. The bottom line is that we're not going to see them yet, and it may be some time before we do. On this one, Trump came up a loser, no question about it, that he couldn't be above the law. And the New York DA, Cyrus Vance, appears to be the big winner of the two forces that the court had to deal with, that is the Congress and the district attorney from Manhattan County in New York. Let me explain the two cases. The New York DA case, if you will, the Supreme Court decided in a bipartisan vote of 7-2 that the president is not absolutely immune from a criminal investigation. There is no categorical immunity for Trump. The Supreme Court wasn't concerned, as Trump raised the question, about harassment directed at Trump from other DAs across the country. Trump can argue to the trial court to narrow the production of the grand jury. The district judge in New York has already scheduled a deadline for Trump this upcoming Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. He can argue about overbreath or whether it's intrusive. The tax records, once narrowed, and we hope it's a brief proceeding, by the lower court decision will be turned over to the grand jury in Manhattan. They will only become public if the DA issues an indictment that makes reference to him or there are other proceedings that follow. It is conceivable that we might know something before Election Day as a result of the DA's efforts. The second, the congressional case, and there actually were four House committees, and the court said that the president can't say no, but there is separation of powers, and the congressional request, the Supreme Court said, must be tethered to four factors, including a legislative purpose. And that question is forwarded to a lower court to conduct that inquiry. That'll be at the instance of the Congress. And the Speaker of the House, Pelosi, said they're going to follow up on that. This, in a way, is an opinion disfavoring the Congress. There's a harsher and harder threshold to overcome. This will not result in public production unless and until the lower court reaches that decision, so that'll probably be sometime after the election. Now, there's another thing to add here, and that is if the congressional case was tethered, if you will, to a criminal matter such as an impeachment or a censure, then it might have done better. It also seemed to run aground in the oral argument before the Supreme Court that it had so many categories and raised so many questions about breath. But that's second guessing, and it's always easy to say what else might have made a difference, but it may have made no difference at all. The background for this dispute goes back to the efforts by Trump to pay off two women for their silence so that it wouldn't affect his election. Since the 2016 campaign, Trump has promised to release his taxes when the audit is concluded. And in recent days, he said, maybe we thought the audit was done and we had an agreement and we don't, and so now it's going on forever. Well, the truth is that you can never trust anything Trump says unless it's an admission against his own interest, and I don't think that is. And so you can't trust that that is the true case. And we'll only find out what the true case is when and as these records are distributed to either the DA in New York or the House, and the House won't get it probably until next year. Now, this has raised all manner of suspicious rumors about what these tax records might show. Why is he withholding these returns? And prompted much public curiosity. But also, more important, these official inquiries. And it's those official inquiries that ended up in the Supreme Court and are the more likely to lend truth to what really is going on. Now, no one is asking Trump directly for his taxes. That's another element you should know about. They're asking third parties, the accounting firms and banks that work with Trump on his returns and have the Trump tax returns that Trump has refused to produce despite his campaign protestations that he was going to do so. In the case of the Congress, the House Oversight Committee wanted to investigate hush money payments to a porn film actress and whether Trump inflated his assets and obtained loans and reduced his taxes in some form or other. The House wants the information to consider legislation. Their objective is not a criminal investigation or a criminal prosecution, and I think that matters in the law, even before the Trump administration. Going back to the case of United States against Nixon in 1974, in which the question, with a looming criminal case pending, the president was asked to produce recordings from the Oval Office. And he didn't want to do that, and he refused it. He litigated it in court, and they said he had to produce it. Now, Trump argued the Congress had no legitimate need to the current records. The Supreme Court was concerned that the House may have made an overbroad request, as I've said. Unlike the DA's request, you know, it wasn't a criminal investigation, and I think that was critical to their decision. Now, as for the request by the New York DA, once Vance gets the information, and he's asked for 8 years of business and personal tax records for his criminal investigation, he's looking into hush money payments made in the run-up to the 2016 election when Trump was a citizen. So I think that matters. It's not entangled with any official functions of the president. Mr. Trump, as you may know, reimbursed Michael Cohen, his fixer lawyer, for the payments he made to quiet Stormy Daniels, who admitted to an affair with Mr. Trump. Sex scandal. Politics will do more about that than the things that really hurt so many more people. But we have tape recordings, we have the witness Cohen, we have additional evidence before, that is before DA Vance gets these tax records. Trump said he was absolutely immune from criminal investigations while he's president. But the courts question, how could that be if there's no authority in the Constitution for such a position as he took? In the end, by their opinions, they have rejected that argument. Now, the Bronx DA cited the Nixon case, and it appeared before that decision, based on oral argument, that the New York DA had the stronger hand. And so the Supreme Court confirmed that was the case when they issued their opinion. This is significant in another way that not everybody's focused on. In the past, the Supreme Court's only considered federal criminal investigations. But in this case, they're looking at state prosecution. A state prosecution or investigation by the grand jury that results in a subpoena to the president. This is the new law, and this is unprecedented that a state could do it. And that's why Trump was saying, well, you know, we'll be harassed because prosecutors across the country, local DAs, will be prosecuting us. And the court just brushed that aside. It does raise questions about how far can and will Vance go in New York. There's no bar to interfere with his discretion because this is a state prosecution. It's not part of the Justice Department headed by Consigliere Barr, who represents really the president and not the justice system. And in New York, Vance has a statute of limitations breathing down his neck. So he's anxious to move this along, and he said it, and there's already a misdemeanor charge that has been lost because of the loss of time. Now, there is no double jeopardy claim because, say, for example, he were to indict the president. The president can't claim double jeopardy because he hasn't been prosecuted before. In addition, what we have is that we have a president who can't be pardoned. That is to say, if it's a state prosecution, whenever it happens, no president can pardon him because the pardon only extends to federal jurisdiction. So that's the sorry state of affairs for the president, which gives us encouragement going forward. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about where do we stand and the question of the ever-expanding pandemic in America. Stay tuned.
Ultimately, it's not a matter of if schools should reopen. It's simply a matter of how. They must fully open, and they must be fully operational.
lot of people think Betsy DeVos is out of touch with working class America, but you listen to me and you listen to me right now, okay? Every morning, Betsy DeVos is up at 5 a.m. putting her children on their flight to school. So don't you tell me she's out of touch, okay?
Let's talk a little bit about the pandemic. The numbers that we're looking at on a daily basis of infections are stratospheric. The deaths that seem to have slowed seem now to have lagged the increased infections, and so the deaths are now climbing. There are several issues in America, but on this question, the most important question is, did we err in opening too soon and too widely and fail in that opening to conform to the guidelines of the CDC and other infectious disease experts? Well, the answer is clear that we reopened too soon or too widely, and as a result, we gave people the impression they didn't really have to distance and they didn't have to wear masks. We're all well aware by now that the question of masks has become a political right for some people instead of a matter of science and safety in health from spreading and perhaps receiving an infection from another person. And one of the big problems is a lot of the people who have the infection are asymptomatic. They don't indicate to anyone else that they have this problem. So that's where we stand. In the general community, we see some pulling back. It's not clear that it's sufficient enough. But the big argument that's riling up the country is, what do we do with the children going back to school in September? Now, in Loudoun County and Fairfax County, where I am, they have offered, if you will, alternatives. You can go to school 2 days, or you can do distance learning at home, and they're going to take certain precautions. Now, if my daughter was going to school these days, she would be doing distance learning. There are too many factors that can go wrong, and too little is still known about how this is going to affect children. And if they get ill or even are asymptomatic, there is a question that we haven't answered yet about what is the long-term effect on other organs in the body, even if you don't come down with the illness full-blown and don't die. So, and another question that we have is that this reminds us of the category of nursing homes and so forth, in the sense that children are going to be in rooms for a whole day, and some not-so-smart public officials in the Trump administration say, well, people go to Costco. Yeah, but they don't sit there for 7 or 8 or 9 hours in relatively small rooms, even at 6 feet apart, with some kids who are perhaps too young to discipline themselves. And I don't say this as a criticism. I've been a parent. I am a parent. And other parents share this as well. So why aren't we allowing for this flexibility? Trump has basically said, it only matters if you open the school and you open it full and the children are there and get over it and we can do this. The president has said, we can even, you know, make the requirements more liberal. In other words, relax the safety standards to encourage people without those standards, without the protections in place, to go to school and to risk becoming ill. We're talking not just about children. We're talking about teachers, all manner of people who serve the operation of a school, the bus drivers. And then you have children that are going home, and sometimes, particularly because of the pandemic, now a grandmother or grandfather might be there. They might live there normally. You have adult parents who may be young or old and may be vulnerable and may have comorbidities, as they say. So the administration brushes these things aside. And that's why I say that Trump promotes the virus. He does not protect us from the virus. And his theory is, first of all, he values life less. But secondly, he hopes we'll force people to work, the economy will recover, and I will win despite all my other character flaws just because the economy is better. Well, that doesn't work. It doesn't work as an election tactic, and it doesn't work in terms of the human safety that's required. And so when you hear DeVos on the air talk about Fairfax as elite because it is trying to manage the very large population of students it has that it says would take up five Pentagons to have enough space for all the children they have to distance and give them all the protections that they need. DeVos has no use for that at all. Trump has no use for that at all. And it's because they have no empathy or caring truly for children. And in turn, for their parents and those who can be infected. And they keep saying, well, we really do care, but then the programs that they put in place do not satisfy that. So, this is the second point of that. I'd like to make a couple of concluding remarks about where I think we stand. Stay tuned.
Roger Stone was treated horribly. Roger Stone was treated very unfairly.
If you lie for the president, if you cover up for the president, if with you withhold information that could incriminate the president, he will protect you. He will make sure that, unlike other people, you don't have to go to jail.
Our nation is at a crossroads. The question is, will we fulfill the promise of America? That is, that everyone is equal, and that we are a country of laws and a constitution, and we follow it and respect it, and encourage all to do so. We have a person in the West Wing, hopefully temporarily, who does not believe in that kind of America. He believes in an America where the white are supreme, that we are an island unto ourselves in an ever-shrinking world, that he can disregard and usurp the powers of the co-equal branches of government that are interdependent, that is, the judiciary and the legislature. We have a government that is not concerned about appropriate demeanor, concerned about comity, getting along with others. We actually have a government that is modeled on an organized crime syndicate, with Trump at the head of it doing whatever he wills to get whatever he needs to be reelected or for his personal corruption. And that's not an America that was our America. And so what this election is about restoring the republic that we had and working on whatever defects we had and improving those. That's why you see Republicans and independents saying that we need an alternative to Trump, one we can trust, and Biden is that person. Other candidates might not be, but Biden is the right man for this time, for this situation. We have to act as a coalition. This morning when I did a walk and talk, I talked about us being a shared coalition of pain and dreams. Our pain is obvious. It's Trump. Is Trump in the context of his lawless nature and how he became president and how he persists and tries to conceal and destroy anything that would show who he really is. We have a president who is promoting a virus, putting the nation at risk. We have a president that makes us indistinguishable from third world despots in other nations across the world. His friends are Erdogan. He likes Putin, who's probably his puppeteer. But our dream is to restore the republic that we had, to restore the promise and the soul that was America. And we will do that. We will do that because from this day until the election, we will talk to everyone we can and talk the truth about where we stand and what we hope for this nation. It may be a family member. It may be a list of people that you talk to on Facebook. It might be a local op-ed in a newspaper. You may have a platform of your own. You may have any number of ways that you can be effective. You do what you can. You don't do something you can't do. But you do it however small an effort it is, because together it becomes a force that will overcome this despot that we have in the White House, who has betrayed our nation's promise and future. Thank you for paying attention. I talked a little bit more this week, but it seemed to me that it was a time for analysis, and I hope that you found this helpful. Please subscribe and join us again next Sunday when we finish our next podcast. All the best. Be safe. Bye-bye.
because we all know this administration loves deleting history faster than Anthony Weiner when he hears footsteps.